Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, everybody, and this is the Wild Wild Podcast, back again into the radioactive future wastelands of the future. And last time we were in 2020, we're travelling backwards and forwards in time again in this episode. But before we get to our final destination, let me introduce, ourselves, I suppose. My name is Adrian. And I'm happy to be here with my co-host and what did I say you were called? The man of 1,000 podcasts.
Well, I thought you were going to say co-conspirator, but okay, yeah, sure.
Rod. Well, that as well. It's Rod Barnett. Hello, Rod.
Hello, Adrian. Thank you for the kind introduction. I, too, love delving into the post-apocalyptic future where we're all irradiated and none of us are fertile.
Yeah. What was it that Criswell said? We are all of us interested in the future because that is where we will spend
the rest of our lives.
Actually, I'm just reading. There's a new book out on Criswell at the moment.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's mainly just full of his.
His predictions. That was a book. Yeah, he published a book of those while he was still very much in the public eye way back when.
This is a new book that is like about his life, but also it's just got loads of quotes of his mad predictions. It's pretty funny. Anyway, so I'm thinking about the future quite a lot at the moment, and so we've got slightly out of sync with recording these episodes and then releasing them. So yesterday at the time of recording, the new episode only went out yesterday, so this one will be eventually I will catch up, but so we're kind of speaking from the past here
into
this
future.
Episode about the future, into the future. I think last time we spoke about some exciting new announcements in Italian genre Blu-ray releasing that you were involved in. I think since then there haven't been any more that I'm aware of.
Not any strange European stuff coming to Blu-ray that I'm aware of that is of note. Okay. And if so, I apologize.
Nothing that you need to plug at the moment.
No. There are a couple of things in the hopper that I can't talk about quite yet. Yeah. I don't know why, considering in one case a particular Blu-ray has been announced, but the extras haven't been announced. It's not a European genre film. It's an American genre film, so that's a different thing.
Ooh. Very good. Yeah, and I've got a couple of things that I did nearly 2 years ago that are about to come out, but they haven't been announced yet. So I guess we'll just plug all this stuff eventually when it does come out.
Yes.
It's probably worth also just mentioning there's a couple of exciting bits of genre related news. that I'm aware of. So the BFI over here, the British Film Institute, have just announced a Dario Argento season in May, where they will be screening restored versions of 17 Dario Argento films.
Wow, that's so almost
I haven't counted. Is that all of them? I don't know.
That's if not but, all of them, it's close.
Yeah. So they're going to be doing restorations, showing restorations of all of his films, and Dario Argento will be there for some of the screenings and events and stuff. So that's pretty cool. I will do my best to get along to some of that if I can. About 10 years ago, they did a Gothic season at the BFI, and they did a, I think it was Deep Red or Suspiria, and Argento came to do the introduction. But back then, I wasn't really into Argento. So, but I happened to be in the BFI that day because I was doing some research. So I went along and just stood by the green room before the event so that I could see Dario Argento in the flesh. So I did see him come out and say hi to some fans and then go into the event, but I didn't actually go. And I'm kicking myself now, of course. But yeah, so this is a chance for me to make amends, hopefully, and get along to that. So that'll be really cool. And also just a couple of other things I saw this week. Indicator made a couple of interesting announcements. They're releasing on Blu-ray and UHD Blackmagic Rites.
Oh.
And what was the other one? I'm going to have to just briefly look this up because I've forgotten. But it was there was another one that was like a giallo. Blackmagic, I mean, these are all very often these are films I've never seen. So I've never seen Blackmagic Rites. Oh, yeah, the other one is Cold Eyes of Fear.
Oh, yeah, Cold Eyes of Fear, the Gastaldi, Castellari film,
Castellari. And Black Magic Rites is, what's his name, Polselli?
I can't remember how to pronounce his name, but I'm telling you now, it's a crazy film, yeah.
Yeah, Renato Polselli, who we just talked about last time because one of his films is in this box set that you've got.
That's true.
That was the Monster of the Opera, whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so this stuff just keeps coming.
Thank goodness we live in sometimes completely amazing times.
Yeah, halcyon days. Speaking of which, so last time the film we spoke about, 2020 Texas Gladiators, was only apparently available on a VHS, but our film this time has actually had a Blu-ray release, which is
several of them actually.
Nice. Well, yeah. So shall we get into it? Let's talk about this week's film, 2019 Escape from New York. I mean, 2019 After the Fall of New York.
Actually, wouldn't the full title be something along the lines of After the Fall of the Planet Earth? I mean, why are we focusing on New York, for God's sake?
2019 is a year when, I think they said it was 10 years earlier. It's, I don't know, 10 or 20 years since the atomic war.
Far too short a time for as much devastation and mutation and strangeness as we are witness to in this film, I think.
Yeah, this is a... I mean, we've had crazy many times on this podcast, but this one is really up there, and there's a lot to unpack with this film. But before we get into the plot, why don't we talk about Sergio Martino?
Oh, gladly.
I'm trying to remember if we've actually had a Sergio Martino film before on the podcast.
Well, I don't think it would seem weird
if we haven't.
We have not, as a matter of fact. We've come close. Oh. He did, after all, Martino did direct and have a hand in just about every genre you can imagine.
Well, yeah.
But we've not
done... Amazing guy.
Yeah, but we haven't done anything that he's directed until this
film. That's quite impressive, because, like you said, he's done a bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, do you have any, looking back at his extensive career, I mean, he's still, we were still working up until quite recently, but do you have any favorites?
Oh God, any favorites? I have a list of favorites that's at
lots
least
of favorites.
Yeah, at least 10 films long. Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward, I think, is an astonishing film. Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. All the Colors of the Dark, Torso.
Yeah. Island of the Fishmen, or whatever that one's
called. I do have much love for that film. Jules Verne, by way of of the Italians. It's amazing. I do love it. Mountain of the Cannibal God. I will.
Cannibal God is great.
He did one of my favorite of the very last spaghetti westerns in '77. Manana or Man Called Blade, or yeah, Man Called Blade is another title for that. Just amazing stuff.
Yeah, I'm surprised we managed to miss him with the Poliziotteschi films, because he obviously did Suspicious Death of a Minor, Silent Action, Violent Professionals. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy was, pretty impressive. I think I've met him. I know I say this occasionally on the podcast.
Really?
I've got such a terrible memory. I'm pretty sure I met Sergio Martino, because he did Mrs. Ward, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I went, I'm sure I've told this before, I went to a conference in 2015 in Rome that was based entirely around Mrs. Ward. And a bunch of people involved were there, including him and, unfortunately, not Edwidge Fenech, although she was due to turn up, but then she didn't come. But George Hilton was there as well. And, yeah, a few other people. It was pretty cool. But, again, this was early days of my foray into Italian cinema, so I didn't really appreciate just how great it was to meet him, because I'd probably only seen a handful at that point.
I think it's funny that it would be George Hilton who turns up. I mean, Hilton was married to Sergio Martino's cousin for a long while.
Oh right, okay.
Yeah, and so they were family for a long period of time, and then of course Miss Finch was married to Sergio's brother. For a period of time.
Because he made a bunch of the comedies, didn't he? His brother was
exactly
comedies. Yeah, so Sergio Martino is a legend, and he often pops up on all the Blu-rays that now have got interviews with him and stuff. He's quite happy to talk about his life, and the book that I'm using this season, After the World Ends, has also got an interview with him where he talks about 2019.
Yeah,
so we can dig into that a little bit. But the cast, I was almost going to say, we should just start calling this the George Eastman season, because here he is again.
Yep. Playing Big Ape.
Big Ape, yeah. There's not that many other people in here that are recognisable, really. Was there? It's quite an unknown cast.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Was there anybody that you're aware of in here?
Only after the fact. I mean, of course, the lead actor is famous as an American... who wasn't really an actor. He was more of a model who ended up making four very, very interesting films in the 80s before his career went away. And of course,
how do you even pronounce his name?
Here's the horrible thing is I just watched 2 days ago. I just watched an interview with him where he pronounces his own name, and I made a note of how he pronounced his name. And now I've, of course, forgotten it. So,
it's such an unusual surname. Michael Sopcu.
I think you're close.
I don't know.
Anyway, he was in four incredible films and then went away. Ever since then he's just done different things, and apparently is fairly successful with glass bottles. He distributes glass bottles that are designed to protect the contents from sunlight, so they're used for medicinal things, and it's
fair
weird. anyway,
we
have him, but I'll be honest, the other actor in the film who it turns out I was always impressed by with her in this movie, but I didn't realize how extensive her career was. Is Anna Kanakis?
Oh, okay.
Who's one of the bad guys?
Is she the one that is like second in command,
right,
in the
with the long dark hair? Yeah, yeah. She's besides being an absolutely gorgeous woman, I mean, she She was crowned Miss Italy in the year 1977. And apparently there was some controversy when she was disqualified to be Miss World in 77 because it turned out that she was only 15 years old at the time, and you have to be older than that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Anyway, she's okay. Amazing, and she had an incredibly long career. She was briefly married. Well, briefly. She was, for like 3 or 4 years, she was married to Claudio Simonetti.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I have met him.
So have I. Wonderful guy. Love him to death.
He's always on tour, that guy.
But she has had an incredible career. And now I look at all the stuff that she was in, and I'm surprised that I haven't seen more of it. But just so much of it since the 90s has been, been long stretches on different television series and then Italian movies that just don't seem to travel outside of Europe. No. So.
But she did do The New Barbarians, so she was part of that trilogy.
Right.
So that's this was not her first rodeo in the apocalypse.
Not at all.
Yeah, she's cool. There's also the other female lead is Giara, played by Valentine Monnier. She's French because I believe this was a French co-production.
Yes, correct.
So I don't really know her. I think she's primarily just in French stuff. But she is in that legendary film that never got finished, Grizzly 2.
Oh, she is? Oh, that's okay. I did not realize that.
Which I believe has now been finished. I'm sure I read something about that recently.
Well, I don't know if it's been finished. I do know that you can watch it. I just haven't done it yet.
Not sure I really want to. But
I do. I just know I'm going to need to be in the correct mood.
Yes. Isn't George Clooney in that or somebody like that?
Yes, a very young George Clooney has a small role in that, yes.
There's and the cast here, there's another connection with last week's films, obviously George Eastman, but also Hal Yamanuchi is back, who was the Japanese martial arts expert that was part of their gang in the last film. And he's back here basically dressed as Fu Manchu.
Yeah.
So, not conforming to stereotypes at all.
No, there is no latent or obvious racism built within the story structure in any way, shape, or form. No.
Yeah. There's some quite odd characters in this film, aren't there? There's also another guy back from the Bronx Warriors, I think, Romano Pupo. Does he play the...
Oh, yeah.
Is he the guy with the eye patch?
Was he Ratchet?
He's
I can't...
Ratchet.
Let's see. He actually... if memory serves, I'm trying to remember the names of the two guys that go along with our main character.
There's Ratchet and Bronx.
Yeah, Ratchet is the guy who is the big bald guy. So yes, you are correct.
And he's also in The Commander, which is one of Antonio Margheriti's kind of men on a mission films. Mm-hmm. And he's in The Last Shark. The Great Alligator. He's in a load of cool stuff, this guy.
Yes, he was.
Oh, and the Heroin Busters. Excellent, which we've seen him in. So, quite relatively sort of small scale, no massive names, but they are people that have been working.
Right.
I mean, George Eastman's probably the most recognisable face in the whole film. Although we should, of course, also mention Edmund Purdom, president of the Pan American Corporation, who I believe wasn't he the high school principal in Pieces?
The college
yeah, whatever it is, the college. Oh. Yeah, it's not a high school, is it?
Not,
the college president or whatever they call them.
Yes, the dean.
The dean.
Jeez, I couldn't remember. How could I not think of that that word? That was pathetic.
Yeah.
But
Edmund Purdom.
Yeah, this is during the long stretch of Edmund Purdom's career when he was essentially doing anything and everything. He would go from things like The Winds of War, a prestige television miniseries here in the States, to, Don't Open Till Christmas in England. And you'd be just looking at him and going, what is driving you? What is having this effect on you?
Did he also have a gambling problem?
I do not know. I kind of want to know because, my God, his career is so varied. I mean, he did a number of Jess Franco films in the 70s. And it's just, you do wonder. I mean, one day he's working, on a BBC television play, and the next he's doing White Slave Ship. What are we doing here? It doesn't matter to me. He's certainly a good enough actor, and he's fine in this too. But it's a
well-rounded career.
There you go. How's that?
Yeah. So yeah, this is a fun film, and this on the surface appears to have a pretty decent budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they're on location for a start. Not only in New York, but there are sequences down in Nevada, I guess. But they're definitely out in the Midwest. I think they're in Monument Valley.
Yeah, and it's those beautiful vistas that most of us who've watched Westerns, at least American-made Westerns, are familiar with. I mean, they turn up in all the old John Ford Westerns, and they even turn up in Once Upon a Time in the West for Sergio Leone, and it was one of those wonderful moments when you realize, oh crap, they're actually on location. But that is something that Sergio Martino, strangely enough, was able to do fairly frequently.
That's true.
He had access to money sometimes that I don't think a lot of other producers of his day necessarily had. It's kind of amazing. He and Castellari both seemed to be able to get into America, especially in the early to mid 80s, even through the late 80s, and make some on location stuff there.
Was Nightmare Beach, was that his?
No, Nightmare Beach was something that was concocted by. Oh, wow. Okay, how do I start with Nightmare Beach? Nightmare Beach.
That's the one that's in Florida.
Yeah, that has Umberto Lenzi.
Oh yeah, that was it.
Connections, and that's an interesting film all on its own. But
yes,
Nightmare Beach has Umberto Lenzi and a couple of other people who were involved in it.
That was it.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. That one was shot in Florida, so you do. Mm-hmm. There was a period of time where several different states, Louisiana and Florida. Eventually Carolina was doing the same thing. One of the Carolinas. We have too many Carolinas. There should just be one. controversial statement. They were passing these laws in these various states to make it easier for production companies to come there and shoot. And so I don't know if they were able to get some deal to come out to shoot in Monument Valley, but it does add a feeling of legitimacy to American eyes, at least, to realize, oh, they're actually there.
Yeah,
and I guess it does kind of counteract some of the, shall we say, less than convincing special effects miniature work we get when we get to New York. Yeah,
there's some great miniature work in. Well, there's a lot of miniature work in this film. How great it is debatable. But it is very Antonio Margheriti sort of reminiscent in places. Let's have a go at the plot, shall we? So the year is 2019, 20 years after the firestorm. So there appears to have been a war between two main groups. You've got the America, effectively, and the Pan American Federation, and then the URAX, which is some kind of Europe and Asia and Africa coalition.
Right.
And they're the ones who've bombed the world and destroyed it. So Manhattan is now a ghost island, a mass of concrete between the East and Hudson Rivers, under the control of the URAX, a military monarchy, using what few survivors and children of the atom remain to experiment on as part of a genetic engineering program. And then, sterility has become the norm for 10 years, and the twilight of mankind is in sight. So it's quite an interesting setup. So not only are they surviving in this post-apocalypse world, but also now everybody's sterile. All the women are sterile.
They're a little unclear about the extent of the sterility. Is it just the women who have a problem, or is it men as well? Because
that's what Big Ape would have you believe.
Yeah, but they never nail down whether or not. I mean, granted, don't get me wrong. If all the women can't reproduce, then it doesn't matter if the men are sterile or not. But it does factor into the not so surprise ending of the story. So
yeah, we're in sort of Children of Men territory here,
right?
But of course, the main inspiration for this film is clearly Escape
from That City.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is clearly the body of this film is, I mean, you know, they try to give us some Road Warrior imagery, some Mad yeah. Max 2 imagery at the beginning of the movie,
which is actually really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
So we meet this character Parsifal, played by our guy whose name we can't pronounce, Michael Sopcu. And so he's called Parsifal. Actually, I wanted to mention this because the name has epic and historical meaning, mm-hmm. and it's sort of interesting that they've chosen this name.
Yeah,
because Parsifal is actually part of the legend of the Holy Grail, and it goes back to, I looked this up on Wikipedia because I'm a good researcher. And basically, Parsifal is a young man who is a pure fool, which means that he is an innocent good man who slowly starts to understand the world. So he's pure enough to be able to go and bring back the Grail. So there are these legends about Parsifal. And then Wagner actually wrote an opera about it called Parsifal.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And in this film, they do kind of take a pass at giving some details about this guy that would lead you to believe that he could kind of fit that mold. Because in that battle we see, that contest at the beginning, he does win what looks to be a woman who just, you know, now is his, and he doesn't mistreat her at all. As a matter of fact, he sets her free with all the money that he won from the contest. So there is this attempt to paint him as a kind of a paladin, a kind of really, you know, a knight who is honorable to a degree.
Yeah, it says here that he is a former elite soldier of the Pan-American Federation,
mm-hmm.
and he survives by wandering from camp to camp across the desert, participating in cruel death races. And it's a cross between Mad Max 2 and Death Race 2000. A
little bit.
Where you've got these two spiked, tricked-out cars smacking into each other. It's actually really good.
It's actually a lot
surprised.
Of fun. Yeah.
It's clearly just in a quarry somewhere just outside Rome, but it looks great. And so he wins, like you said, and they give him this girl, and they ride off on a motorbike, and then he lets her go. But then he gets taken by some people in a helicopter who have these lasers that knock people out or something. And when he wakes up, he's in Alaska. Could you describe for the listeners what Alaska looks like in this film?
It looks like a cotton-covered miniature. That's what it looks like. I'm willing to go along with it because I love stuff like this. It's not for me, it's not a huge hurdle to accept this kind of stuff. The same way, it's not a huge hurdle for me to accept some of the silly, not quite excellent, shall we say, cityscapes of New York that we get here soon. But it's effective enough, and it does feel like they're trying really hard to kind of broaden out the feel of the story, so that we're traveling from the desert southwest to the frozen norths, and then we're going to New York City. And of course, there is a part of me that knows that after we get the plot in motion here, it's like we're on a clock. And this stuff takes these are far distances, people. I mean, to get from Alaska to New York, that takes some time, even if you're flying. So
they've got to bring this all in under 90 minutes.
There's
a lot to cram in. So the president of the Pan-American Confederation, Edwin Purdom, has selected him for a top secret important mission. Apparently, their computer has identified that the last fertile woman left on Earth is in New York. And they're sending him in, Snake Plissken style. I was almost expecting him to be like, it would be really funny if there'd been a scene where he's walking through New York down an alley, and coming in the opposite direction is Snake Plissken, and they just kind of they just give each other a nod as they walk past. You know?
Yeah, brief wave and a nod. Yeah,
they've both got their missions. So he's been sent in, but unlike Snake Plissken, he's not gonna be killed if he doesn't do it. He's going to be rewarded, because this film is actually really quite sci-fi, more so than the previous films. They are planning to reboot mankind somewhere in Alpha Centauri, So they've offered Percival a seat on the spaceship that's going to take this woman and all the remaining members of the Pan American Federation off the planet, mm-hmm. out into space to start all over again. So so it's quite an interesting. So that's his motivation, is to help save mankind and get out of Dodge, leaving the Earth to just die off slowly under the control of the Urax, I guess.
I suppose,
bit bleak, but there you go. But he's not going to have to do this mission alone. He's got two friends two guys that are going to go with him. So one is a guy called Bronx, who, as the name suggests, knows New York really well. And his family were all killed by the Urax, and he's quite annoyed about that. But he knows the city and can help him to get around. And then also this other guy we mentioned before called Ratchet, who's got... Ratchet is... He's got an eye patch.
Yep.
And he's really strong. Bronx, I was getting it confused because Bronx has got one hand missing.
Yes,
and
he does.
He's got like a metal grabber for a hand, which comes in quite handy, no pun intended, later on in the film.
You know, if you'd not brought my attention to it, I would not have realized that you were punning there.
I didn't do it on purpose. It just kind of came out. So anyway, so that is the setup. So with Bronx and Ratchet, he's got to get into Manhattan. But like they say here in the book, getting in was never the tricky part of the plan. It was getting out.
Yes.
So he's got to get in, find this woman, which I don't think they ever tell him where to find her or what her name is or what she looks like or anything like that.
And they're really, 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 really vague about how they know that there is a fertile woman and that they know where she is. Really vague.
Yeah,
I should stress that.
Yeah. So then, I mean, the rest of the film is just, adventures through New York, meeting various gangs, making friends, fighting the Urax. He gets taken by the Urax along with this woman that he's met that he says is the woman they're looking for, but it turns out she's not, and that's Giara. Mm-hmm. And they get taken into the...
admit, you could get fooled. I mean, because she's a pretty blonde woman who's not covered with the scars and pustules that all these other people are covered in. So it's like, well, wait a minute, maybe she is.
She'll do. So they get taken to the Death Star, and then we get like a whole Star Wars section of the movie with sets that look like they're left over from the humanoid.
This is true.
And it says in the interview here with Sergio Martino, he says, I don't think Star Wars influenced me in any way. And as to Mad Max, I must confess to never having seen it. So, I mean, believe that if you like.
Well, he said in another interview that he'd only seen like certain scenes out of Mad Max 2. And I can kind of believe that because there is this desire sometimes to try to avoid seeing things because then you can't repeat them unconsciously. But when you're wallowing in this very small pond, there's only so many ways that you can stir up the mud, and so it turns out that there are very few ways that you can do these things that aren't going to seem reminiscent of other larger budgeted films.
Yeah.
And let's just pause for a moment to marvel at the wonder of the mid-80s, where we could have movie after movie after movie like this. I mean, we're going to cover 10 of these things, and we could probably cover another 10 and drive ourselves insane, don't get me wrong. But there was a period of time. I was a teenager when these films were coming out, when these things were hot off the presses, being shown in movie theaters, were they were the new thing. These things could be counted upon regardless of how well they were made or how large the budget. You know, they were going to be able to make their money back. This was a genre that was hot. And there was that period of time in my teenage years, as I went off to college, where I started to notice, man, there seemed to be fewer of those things. I thought this genre would live forever. No, it did not. It gets the occasional little resurgence over the past few decades, for which I'm grateful. Don't get me wrong. But I would have thought when I was in my teenage years that the post-apocalyptic genre was essentially going to be, you know, we're going to have 20 years of them overtaking the Western and becoming the predominant way in which we spoke about action cinema. And man, I was just wrong. My appetite for these things is apparently much larger than the general public's.
Yeah. There have been some fun kind of deliberately retro returns to the genre. Did you ever see Turbo Kid?
No, I know it's supposed to be fantastic, but I've still not watched it.
Yeah, and that's definitely right in this world.
Okay.
That's a good one to watch out for. I mean, Martino, he kind of points more towards Blade Runner as being an influence. But also, interestingly, when he was filming at De Paola Studio, he said that they had got their Streets of Once Upon a Time in America there. Mm-hmm. And they'd had a big fire a couple of years earlier. So he's filming in those kind of burned out Once Upon a Time in America buildings for some of this, which is pretty cool. But I also love all the stuff in the scrapyard. There's one where early on in the film, when he first gets into New York, there's a big chase through a load of old smashed up buses, which is really cool.
And I don't know if that was in somewhere in America or in Italy or where it was. It's hard to tell from the buses, but it's an impressive location. And it's one of those things where I wonder if it's a situation where they found the location and realized, oh, we could stage a chase here. Let's do this here. Because it works really well and it looks fantastic. And it, once again, adds to the feel of the film being larger than it really is.
Yeah, it's really cool. Because, like I said, we've got this kind of sequences inside the evil Urax headquarters that are all very much Star Wars Imperial gleaming surfaces and blinking lights. And all that's missing, there's not many robots. Oh, no, which reminds me, of course, in this world, cyborgs are now illegal. So they've been cyborgs before, but now they've been they're not allowed, which again is perhaps the Blade Runner element creeping in.
Maybe.
But so he's got all this stuff going on. He's got to find this woman. He meets a few different gangs, including the Big Apes gang, which they're basically dressed like new romantic pirates, which, you know, they could have been in an Adam and the Ants music video, so, basically the way they're dressed. They're all dressed like they're in the circus or something. It's pretty cool, but they've mutated and they're starting to turn. Some of them are just wearing ape masks, and then you've got George Eastman, who's just got really hairy. But yeah, they're like a bunch of mutants, I think, is what we're supposed to think they are.
And there are all these different tribes, which of course is the influence instead of gangs, warriors. They're kind of like tribes of different types of mutants. So that's the warriors' influence creeping in. And
Which is where our Fu Manchu guy comes in briefly, the rat eater. Oh, yeah, that sequence with the rats. So, yeah, there's this group, there's this one gang who eat rats, and they come through with these long poles with spikes on the end. And I'm not sure how, I'm pretty sure they are stabbing real rats at points.
They are. There are no two ways about it. Those are. Yeah, this is not a film that on which you could state that no animals were harmed during the filming. So,
I mean, this film is actually, I was surprised when I looked this up, it's still rated 18. There's actually quite a lot of violence in this movie for what is effectively the kind of film, like you were saying, that you could watch when you were younger and be into all that stuff. But it's pretty violent. I've got the BBFC ratings guidance here from when it was last classified, which was for the Blu-ray back in about 5 years ago. So the film includes strong bloody violence, including a man's head exploding bloodily when shot and blood and matter spraying when a man's head is hit with an axe. And then also strong injury detail includes lots of blood at the exit point of a metal pole protruding from a man's body and copious blood flow when a clawed hand stabs a man in the eyes. So yeah, it's pretty full on, this movie, more than you might expect for this genre, but maybe not if you've seen Sergio Martino's films before.
Well, see, that's just it. I mean, I always go back to looking at this, the two biggest templates for this movie and for this genre are always going to be Escape from New York and The Road Warrior, the second Mad Max film. And both of those movies are R-rated for their content. And so I think it was generally felt that if you soften the violence in these movies, people are going to not accept it. And that may have been true, I think. This was, of course, a different time when, I mean, we've gone through different cycles since then, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, softening the material generally was almost always seen as a surefire way to make sure that your audience was going to rebel and that word of mouth would be bad. You know, people would not recommend their friends to go see it because this one doesn't have, you know, the good bits, the parts that you really remember, the violence and things of that nature. So I think they've probably felt to a degree they had to do this kind of stuff. Or they'd lose their, you know, their perceived target audience.
Yeah. And the effects are good. I just wasn't expecting it to be quite so extreme, I suppose. That's my surprise. But yeah, the special effects are quite impressive. And they've got they've got like fun sort of laser weapons and all that kind of sci-fi stuff as well. I was trying to see in the credits, so there's nobody, as far as I can see, that's specifically credited with doing the special effects.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of.
Which is a shame.
Yeah, the although, you know, some of it's quite impressive. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know why we don't have more conversation about the people who are involved in making it, but it's true.
Yeah, completely uncredited. Speaking of credits, we should also mention Ernesto Gastaldi is involved here.
I was going to bring that up because this is yet another, you know,
another legend.
Yeah, Ernesto Gastaldi is someone I know we've talked about before. He had a hand in writing the Savage 3, which we covered a while back. But he did. He first of all, we may never know the number of scripts that he just doesn't get credited on across the time of his career. But the films that we do have his name attached to are just so impressive. I mean, first of all, let's talk about, you know, the fact that you could start in 84 with around the same time he was working on this. He also was working on Once Upon a Time in America for Leone, which is
that little film.
Yeah. Which is a strange thing to take note of. But he wrote The Cynic, The Rat and The Fist, Suspicious Death of a Minor, Gambling City, Almost Human. He did My Name is Nobody, which, you know, is one of the great, you know, well-known spaghetti comedies, one that even I can enjoy somehow. So, and he'd worked for Martino before for doing Torso and All the Colors of the Dark. Mm-hmm. It's, you look at this man's career. He wrote Day of Anger, for God's sake. This man knew what he was doing. And Long Hair of Death, Whipping the Body for Bava, Horrible Dr. Hickok for Freda, Vampire and the Ballerina, if you want to go all the way back to 1960. Gastaldi is one of those guys who seemed to be, first of all, he was very good. And so I almost always attribute in interviews, you can see him kind of joke about this. I always attribute the things that I think are weakest in a film that he wrote to other people, just because it's almost something that I want to believe is true. It's like, well, you know, Gastaldi was smarter than that idea, surely.
Yeah.
But who knows? He kind of laughs about that kind of stuff. I'm not sure. Yeah.
No, he's great. Another name, just quickly while we're on credits, is worth mentioning is the music. Credited as Oliver Onions. But we would, of course, know them better as the De Angelis brothers, Guido and Maurizio. And they did You're the Hunter from the Future.
Yes.
And just a whole bunch of stuff there. They're a lot of good keyboard action back in the 80s. And like Tarantino has reused their music and stuff like that.
I actually went through a period where I kind of turned my nose up at their work. But it was a very brief period of time. It was when I was getting irritated that producers were going on the cheap in a lot of movies from that period, and just, you know, hiring two guys to noodle on keyboards. But honestly, I've grown out of that rather childish view of this stuff, because they're so incredibly talented, and I just get so much of a kick out of their music. I think it's a blast.
I mean, for me, they will always have my undying love because they did the music for Dog Tanyan and the Three Musker Hounds, which was a show. I loved that show when I was a kid. I'm a bit younger than you, so I was the right age when that was out in the 80s.
Oh my lord!
You must know that one.
No, how? What do you mean? I must know this one.
One for all, and all for one. Musker Hounds. That was like compulsory viewing in the 80s if you were a certain age, and it was repeated all the way through the decade, I think. But wow. Yeah, so they've done a lot of stuff. The Last Shark, Iron Master,
oh yeah,
Blade in the Dark. We're going to hear them again in Atlantis Interceptors. Mm-hmm. And obviously Yore, which you and I have both spoken about extensively.
Oh, yeah.
many times.
I'll be honest. It was the score for Yore that really kind of made me realize that I was being a ridiculous stick in the mud about their stuff, because there's no way to not have fun with the score. With that score, it's just incredible. I love it so much.
Yeah, and the score for this is good. I mean, basically, I this is a really quality production. There's a lot going on. Like we said before, there's a lot crammed in, a lot of ideas. Mm-hmm. But I think it holds together quite well. I mean, in the book, they describe it as a bit of a hodgepodge at the crossroads of pop culture, taking inspiration from elements from a variety of sources, a bit of Mad Max 2, hint of Planet of the Apes, a dash of Star Wars, and Sleeping Beauty. But they you know, despite that, they... and also what could be quite, you know, basically a plagiarized plot. But they reckon it turns out to be quite a good film, and I would agree, despite the really obvious use of miniatures and the very recognizable plot elements. I don't know what it is. I just really enjoyed this one. The motorbikes, the sudden outbursts of violence, the bonkers plot, the Star Wars stuff. There's just a lot going on.
Well, I think one of the reasons you may enjoy it is probably the reason that I think I've always enjoyed this one, is that much like Enzo Castellari, Sergio Martino understood how to maintain a straight line through the film. Mm-hmm. You know, there's never a point in the movie where you feel like you're unaware of where we're going, of what's happening. He keeps things not just moving, but relatively focused. We're always aware of what the next goal is and where we're going and how we possibly might do it, unless he wants to, you know, unless there's a little hidden surprise that they've got, you know, up their sleeve. And so, much the same way our last film, we could see that Castellari is able to marshal all of this stuff and focus it down. Martino is able to do that here as well. Now, don't get me wrong, this movie has a few more rough edges than our last movie. This mm-hmm. one feels a little more like certain elements needed to be possibly better explained, or maybe a few spots where you're thinking, well, that could have probably been done better. You know, like you know, for instance, the scene that I now absolutely love, but when I first saw this movie years ago, the scene where they ride up to the outskirts of New York City and we look out over the flat pond at the cityscape of New York City. It's like that's a spot where I'm just like, okay, I now know enough about how these miniatures are done that they needed to set up a couple of fans to blow the water so it looks like it could possibly be an ocean instead of, you know, instead of a bowl of water. But the charm of it now wins me over, even though I still feel that that's, you know, one of the elements that you kind of have to forgive the movie for not having the skill level involved on that particular thing. But it's so fun. The don't get me wrong, it's adult fun. I mean, we've already talked about the level of violence in the movie. Yes. There's no getting around that. But I always worry about this, and this is something that I probably will bring up again with a couple of these other movies that we cover. There's a certain fear that I have that my enjoyment of these movies is going to revolve around a certain amount of nostalgia about how I enjoy these because I not just enjoy the genre, but because I have fond memories of when I first saw them. And that's not happening here. This is one that I think really does stand on its feet. It's mm-hmm. good. It's solid. I think you could probably introduce this to a modern audience, and they would enjoy it.
Yeah,
as long as you know they weren't hidebound by the fact that this, you know, any film that they watch has to be, you know, made in the last 10 years. Yeah. And believe me, there are a lot of people like that. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's an old film that came out in the year 2005. Anyway. This is a fun one. I don't think, and this will be something we probably return to. It's not my favorite, but it's a good one. It's not one I would put at the top of the list, but it is one that I would you know put on that that list of 10 that we're doing here and say, no, this one's worth your attention.
Yeah. Well, we will at the end of the season we shall rank them all and see where it sits. Again, but yeah, this is a great film. Definitely worth digging up the Blu-ray wherever you are. I'm sure you can find it still easily available over here in the UK. 88 Films put it out. I don't know. I didn't look it up to see who put it out in America, but I assume it's out there.
Oh, I think it's been put out a couple of times. Yeah. The most current Blu-ray, I think, is from Code Red, and there are a lot of great interviews on that disc too. Mm. So.
Yeah, check it out. Well, thank you, Rod, for doing this again. Now, last episode, I mentioned the fact that I'd looked at the emails for the first time in forever. And then I also said I would check out reviews. And it turns out we have some reviews on Apple.
Oh, my goodness. I've never seen before. Do I want to hear these?
So thank you, everybody. Well, I think the problem is Apple puts the reviews by country. So I've only, like on my phone, when I look at our podcast, I just see the UK version, but I happened to look at the American page this week and I found we did have some reviews, including one going as far back as May 2021, so quite early in the podcast. So I'm just gonna, so we've got four here that I'd like to share with you. There's one from somebody called ATX Horror. This was the first episode. It says, "The podcast I've been waiting for. Listened to the intro episode and immediately subscribed after hearing what they have planned for the show. Can't wait for more episodes." Oh. Well, thank you, ATX Horror, for giving us that review 2 years ago.
I hope we haven't disappointed in the meantime. Yeah.
I hope you're still listening. And then last year, so we've got a couple last year, Billy Dunleavy says, "Wild indeed. Adrian and Rod are a good team and cover some obscure but very interesting and fun films. Thank you very much." And then we've got one that says, "New favorite podcast. This is my new favorite podcast." Wow. Oh. "After listening to tons of YouTube channels and podcasts where all they do is crack jokes and talk about Independence Day for the 10th time, I finally found something with more depth, substance, and love for filmmaking. Adrian and Rod are very knowledgeable and love all kinds of film and nerdery, but are not snobby about it at all. I always come out learning something new and appreciate all the films they talk about. Thank you."
Very nice, yes.
And finally, we had a review just a couple of weeks ago from somebody called "It's All Right, I'm a Doctor." And they describe us as a classy duo. It says they are knowledgeable and can enjoy imperfect films worth checking out. So, hey, thanks very much. Reviews are, I believe, a really great way to help other people find and perhaps listen to the podcast.
Yes.
So that is much appreciated. Ratings and reviews are something that every podcast you listen to asks you to leave a rating and a review. And I have to confess, most of the podcasts I listen to, I never really get around to it. So I totally understand those of you who are listening who've never done it. But hey, now I know where to look. I will try and check that a bit more often and read them out where I can. But yeah, thanks so much. It's really great to hear that people are enjoying what we're doing.
Yeah, thank you very much for the kind words.
And finally, we had another email since the last episode from Kurt Toy, which is probably pronounced wrong. Sorry, Kurt. He says, "Dear Adrian and Rod, I seem to be stalking Rod across all the podcasts he's part of."
Oh, yeah, okay. He probably is, yes.
"No matter what my motives, I'm enjoying your visits to less talked about genres of Italian cinema." And then he says, in brackets, what genre didn't the Italians do? I mean, that is a good question.
I don't think there's a single genre that they didn't tackle at some point, yeah.
Yeah. So then he says, "Thank you for adding The Tenth Victim to your list of dystopian movies. That's a favourite of mine, and it was good to hear some context about director Elio Petri. Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion is the only other film of his I've seen, and now I'm motivated to check others out." And then he brings up a film that we could have included in this season, but we didn't. He says, "I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about The Seed of Man from 1969. It's definitely post-apocalyptic. It's a late 60s movie that's more interested in themes than plot, but I found engaging, and there are some beautiful scenes." Are you familiar with this one, The Seed of Man?
No, I don't know this film at all, but...
I know I've read about it in the Italian sci-fi book, but no, I haven't seen this one. He says, "A young couple are forced to become refugees from a continent-wide plague. They find a beach house to isolate themselves." This is sounding very familiar. "Then have conflicting views over whether to have a child. They also encounter a dead sperm whale and a live French woman." I'm glad he clarified that she's alive. "It's very different from where post-apocalyptic cinema ended up going, except that there's an explosion at the end." Intriguing. It says, "Director Marco Ferreri made some other provocative type movies like Don't Touch the White Woman. I've been too afraid to check that one out, though."
Yeah, I've never heard of this film before. This is a new one on me. I'm a little daunted by the running time. It's just shy of 2 hours in length.
Okay.
It does seem like a very interesting film. I don't know how easy it would be to see, but definitely on my radar now. Okay.
Yeah. So then he says, "I look forward to the rest of your tour," presumably meaning tour of the apocalyptic wasteland. Thank you, Kurt, with a K. Much appreciated. It's great to hear that you're enjoying what we're doing and that we've helped you to discover Elio Petri a bit more. So that's the kind of thing we're here for. That's our service, is to help people find cool stuff.
Just part of the service, sir.
Yeah. Somebody called Jason also got in touch just to send us a link to a video on YouTube of a documentary about Bronx gang culture in the late 70s. So it would appear, he says, it wouldn't be surprised if it served as an inspiration for Fabrizio De Angelis in creating the Bronx Warriors. So it's called 80 Blocks from Tiffany's. You can find it on YouTube, and I did tweet it out as well. I haven't had time to watch the whole thing, but I've had a look through. It's pretty cool. You know, it's right there. It's like a time capsule of what the Bronx was really like in the late 70s. So
interesting. Okay.
Really worth checking out for some additional kind of social background to the Warriors and the Bronx Warriors especially. So very cool. Finally, before we finish, I'm going to try and remember to do this more often. Next time, we're going to do Endgame. So if you want to play along at home, that is the next movie we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, fairly easy to get hold of. It's recently come out on Blu-ray over here in the States. So
yeah, and brings us back to Joe DiMaggio again.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I'd thought about that. Yeah, that's a detriment for some people, but hey,
is George Eastman in that one as well? I feel like he's becoming our spirit animal.
Oh my goodness, is he?
He might be.
My
I can't remember.
Goodness, I don't think he's in.
Okay, maybe Joe gave him a week off.
Very possible. Yes, very possible. Of course, if he turns up in it, we'll have to bow our heads in shame. But mm-hmm. Yes,
it's becoming like a drinking game.
It's true.
George Eastman's in a film again. anyway, well, thank you everybody for listening.
Is in it.
Hey,
George Eastman is in it.
There you go.
And so is Al Cliver.
Oh, good. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's in that. He's also in Warriors of the Year 2072, I think, Al Cliver.
Oh, I'm glad I thought to look that up. Yes. Because I would feel very embarrassed. Everyone remembers Laura Gimser's in it, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
the men tend to fade into the background in the mind for no good reason. I can't imagine why.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why that would happen. Good. So plenty more to look forward to. And I also did, after a popular demand, create a Letterboxd list of all the films that we've done so far. This will be film number 31 on the list. So, so look us up, Wild Wild Podcast on Letterboxd. I've also tweeted out the link this past week. If you want to follow us on there, that'd be fun. What else can you do? You can get in touch with us by email, which I'm now looking at more regularly. And you can tweet us. We're also on Instagram. You can buy us a virtual coffee, and that's always nice when people do that. Thank you very much. Let us know what post-apocalypse films you like as well, because, you know, as Rod said, there are plenty more that we haven't fitted onto this list. So maybe tell us about some of the films that that you like that we're not covering.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Either way, it's always nice to hear from people to know that we're not just void shouters, as we talked about last time.
It's very easy to fall into that trap, yes.
That there are people at the other end. Anyway, thank you so much, everybody, for listening. And thank you, Rod, for being here. And for apologies for the time zone confusion this week. But
America is such a strange and weird place that we cannot figure out how to sync time clocks across continents. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but hey, once the apocalypse comes, we'll all just go back to sundials, so it'll probably be fine.
We'll just all run it, walk out, stick a branch in the ground and judge it that way.
Yeah, so we should be okay then. All right, well, thanks everybody for listening, and we will be back again soon with more post-apocalyptic fun. Bye for now.
Bye, everyone. For one, and for one, Musker Hounds are always steady. One for all, and for one.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.